Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have with us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, Father Richard Rohr. Richard, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Now, how long have you lived in Albuquerque?
Actually, I've lived here 28 years. This has become home.
Well, that's outstanding. Now, for most of us who watch a little bit of TV, when we hear of Albuquerque, New Mexico, we think of one TV show.
You know, I know what you're going to say, and I never saw it once, but everybody talks about it, yeah.
Now, of course, we're talking about Breaking Bad.
Uh-huh.
And I always hoped there was going to be some plot line in which Walter White would end up at the Center for Action and Contemplation and find the catharsis he needs. But it never happened.
You're the first one to interpret it that way. I wish you had been right.
Well, I always look for that, and it never happened, and so it broke my heart.
No.
So do you get a lot of that when people say you're from Albuquerque? Do they reference
that
show?
Well, of course, just in the last year or so, yeah. And there's actually tours now. People come in little vans and drive around the city and look at the places where different episodes were filmed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry it also gave the city a somewhat negative image, but apparently it was a good drama.
Yeah, it was...
Uh-huh.
Oh, it was an outstanding show, and you need to watch it. But I used to live in West Texas in Abilene, which is a town that probably has a lot of commonalities with Albuquerque.
I bet it does, yeah.
Now, you just came off of a conference. You're doing a Conspiracy for God symposium series?
Yes, we had almost 1,100 people last weekend. It was so exciting. Just, I hope, a wonderful proclamation of good news and healing for a lot of people. And then our living school immediately followed. We have a symposium at the beginning of the school year.
Okay.
So it was a whole week of wonderful teaching and prayer and experience.
Well, I've heard, I've seen some stuff on Twitter and other social media stuff of talking about the symposium series and how great it was.
Well, good. Good.
Now, you had two other speakers out there with you?
Yes. Well, actually, more than that.
Okay.
There's two others who are joined me on the Living School faculty.
Mm.
But at the big Conspire conference was Sister Elia Delio, a Franciscan nun who's both a scientist and a theologian.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really exciting to bring together good science and good theology. And then Rob Bell, who is either loved or hated in evangelical circles, he was just delightful. So, it was a good conference.
How long have you known Rob?
You know, maybe 4 or 5 years, something like it. He wrote me once saying he read my books.
Mm-hmm.
That'll probably make people either love or hate my books now.
you're to blame for Rob Bell, no.
We hope to do more together in the future. I bring my Catholic theology, he brings his evangelical, and we often find ourselves meeting in the same place. So
that's good.
He's a good partner.
Well, I think I actually heard about you first, maybe from him, I'm not sure exactly who, but about 5 years ago, I somehow decided to order a copy of Everything Belongs. And it came in the mail, came in through Amazon, there's a stack of books, and I noticed it just as I was walking out the front door to go for a run. And so I decided, let's open the box and see what books are in there. And so I, you know, saw a copy of Everything Belongs. And as you do when you first get a book, I decided to open it up and start thumbing through it. Next thing I know, it's been an hour. I'm sitting on my kitchen table or on my kitchen, in my kitchen room, and I just read half the book. And I'm going, this is amazing. I'd never heard anything like it. It was just something that opened my eyes to a whole new way of seeing spirituality and Christianity. And I'm assuming that I'm not the only person coming from an evangelical background that has had that experience with your work.
You know, this has been a surprise to me, too. One of my publishers told me that, at least for a certain period, a year or so ago, young evangelical males were my biggest demographic.
Really?
I mean, it just blows my mind. I'm so trained in Franciscan spirituality, which that would help me, I think, be accessible to the evangelical world.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Orthodox Catholic theology. But when you really get good Catholic theology, which is scripture-based, then I think it's not so hard for us to understand one another. But the typical street-corner Catholicism that many people think is Catholicism, that's often where the barrier comes from, you know?
What's the difference in street-corner Catholic theology and Franciscan?
Well, I don't mean this to sound judgmental or superior or anything, but, you know, when I was educated as a Franciscan, I was educated, first of all, in philosophy, how to think. Then the Old Testament, the intertestamental period, the New Testament, of course, then given an honest history of the church, century after century, how these doctrines and practices developed. And when you get historicology like that, you know, most people, if they're honest, they have to respect it. It's just looking at the big picture, you know, as Judaism was so famous for, really. But to be honest, when I speak of street corner, in other words, the church that's on your parish corner. This is going to sound judgmental or superior. I don't mean it to, but it's sort of fast food Christianity or fast food Catholicism.
Yeah.
You know, come to church, go through the sacraments. It often creates very passive people. And I think this is what Protestantism has rightly criticized us for.
Really?
So we in the religious orders often got the Jesuits, the Carmelites, Dominicans, Franciscans, as I am. We often got the bigger education about the bigger picture instead of just running the parish church on the corner.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to put down the parish church on the corner. There's many holy people who go there and work there. So it's not either or, but it is a different emphasis. It really is. They always say both the heretics and the reformers come from the religious orders. And I think it's true because our education is not to be a parish priest, to simply be a company man, but it's to be a gospel man or a gospel woman. And that creates a different emphasis.
Yeah, you in the book talk about, the new book is Eager to Love. You talk about how organized Christianity has missed out on the freedom and the joy of the gospel and settled for something that's nice and proper and accommodating. And then that's what you compare it to fast food religion.
Yeah, I'm saying the same thing. That's right.
Yes.
It's not bad, but it doesn't transform people at a deep level. And I think that's just being honest. And and of course, the Protestant churches see the same thing. It's not that we Catholics have a corner on that, that all of our people have raised up people who are still racist and classist and sexist and bigoted, and they still call themselves Christian.
Yeah.
So every denomination can feed people at a rather immature level and actually keep them there. So it's not the province of any one of our churches.
Yeah. Well, someone, a friend of mine showed me this themes that you have for what you're calling an alternative orthodoxy.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so, there's seven steps. And for people who don't know, let me just give you a quick and dirty take on it. The first is methodology, that's scripture validated by experience and experience by tradition. The second is foundation, Jesus is the face of God. Third is frame, there's one reality. Fourth is ecumenism, where there's no scapegoating. Five is transformation. Six is process, the path of descent is the path of transformation. And the last and the goal of this is non-dual thinking.
Well, you know, don't make it just thinking. The goal is union with God. The goal is always union with God. But until you move beyond dualistic either or with me or against me thinking, you'll never get to union with God, because you'll always find some reason why you're unworthy or other people are unworthy. Yeah.
So what do you think?
Yeah, that's a quick summary. Thank you.
Well, it's kind of awkward trying to summarize your work while I'm talking to you. But let's talk more about this non-dualistic thinking. You talk about the beginning of that, really where it takes a big part of the church's collective conscience, is in the Reformation and the Enlightenment. So talk.
Well, that's when the contemplative mind, which is non-dual thinking. Mm-hmm. When we Catholics use the word contemplative, we mean looking at the moment, the situation, the event, the person, mm-hmm. without categorizing, judging, critiquing, labeling things up and down. Just let it be what it is, as it is, in God, without your analysis. Now, that takes work, how to do that. I would say the first 1,200, 1,300 years of the church taught that in a much more systematic and ordered way in many of the monasteries, many of the fathers of the church. This is very clear teaching.
Yeah.
But by the time we get to the 14th century, 15th century, and that's why the Reformation was needed and was inevitable, we're not teaching that wisdom way of seeing anymore. And so Catholicism itself starts falling into major decline, mm-hmm. And called forth a Reformation. Now, a needed and good Reformation, but the trouble is that the mentality of the Reformation was almost entirely dualistic.
How
on
so?
Both sides. Well, it was all or nothing.
Okay.
You're either 100% right or you're 100% wrong. That's never true.
Yeah.
That's just stinking thinking. and that's the way most revolutions have operated in history up to now, up to really the last century, where, the French Revolution, let's just guillotine everybody who doesn't agree with us. Mm-hmm. We can't hope to reform things that way anymore. And both Protestants and Catholics now see that. But then right after the Reformation, where we divided into either-or groups all over Europe, we had the strangely called event of the Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th centuries, where we very much idealized rational thinking. And, rational thinking is fine, but it can't deal with high-level issues.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read my book, The Naked Now?
Yes. Got a copy sitting right next to me. Yeah.
So issues like love, death, suffering, God, eternity, the rational mind just rolls over and plays dead. It has no idea how to process that. So that's why, it has been Western Christian world, Catholic and Protestant, that has largely produced the phenomenon called atheism. Mm-hmm. Atheists come usually from former Christian countries. People who it didn't work because mm-hmm. we didn't give them the tools of transformation, and then they throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are all the
victims of that.
Yes. Yeah. So tell me about the tools that we would need for transformation so that we wouldn't get stuck in that.
Well, first of all, humility.
Humility?
Humility. In other words, we've got to stop thinking that words are reality.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our killing one another is over using the right words. We're the religion, and you know this from John's gospel, that believes the word became flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Flesh incarnation, as we call it, that's where we meet God. But the educated, sophisticated, and proud mind likes to move back into the control tower of words. And so once you, first of all, learn some humility around your words,
mm-hmm.
but just because you say it doesn't mean you've experienced it, doesn't mean you believe it, or you follow it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that's the starting place for the contemplative mind,
mm-hmm.
to let reality be what it is, right in front of you without categorizing it up or down. That's contemplation.
Okay.
So you have to change the seer. How you see is what you'll see. And when you're immediately trained in what Jesus told us not to do, do not judge, I often think to go to a seminary is to get a a PhD in judgmental thinking, mm-hmm. really.
Yeah.
We're trained. We're more judgmental than other people while calling it, oh, we're doing this for truth or for God.
Why do you think we're more judgmental?
Well, because when you're given the impression that your words and your understanding of words is absolute truth, which is such an absurdity, that your mind or my little mind could ever formulate absolute truth in a form of words. When you walk around with that, you know, I go back to Genesis, which you as an evangelical will appreciate.
I do, thank you.
You know, when Jesus says the only sin is to eat, not Jesus, the Old Testament, Genesis, Yahweh, says, you know, the only sin is to not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's pretty amazing that the whole Bible warns us against this thinking we understand perfectly what is good and evil. So when you do that, we were warned against it at the beginning of the Bible, you create very dualistic people and very judgmental people. And I'm afraid both of our churches have done that.
Well, we definitely have some judgmental ones in my church. As an evangelical, I'm not talking about the specific church I pastor. But what is, like, the other side of that would be, do we just not judge anything? Do we just...
No.
What's the other side of that then?
See, I'm not criticizing you, but that is a dualistic response.
I know.
That is the way most people would respond. Mm-hmm. If it isn't absolutely black and white, then the world's going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why both the Old Testament and the New Testament distinguish wisdom from knowledge.
Okay.
Those are two different gifts of the Spirit. And wisdom is this ability to read reality with a bit more subtlety, with a bit more discernment,
mm-hmm.
and not to immediately say it's one or the other. So the way I usually say it in some of my books anyway is you have to begin each day, each encounter in life with yes. A radical yes of acceptance of what is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that after you've said yes to the person in front of you as a living image of God, that you might at a later moment have to also say, well, no, you know, he sure mistreats his wife. That isn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start with no, I don't like him because he's not a Christian or whatever mm-hmm. your analysis is. I'll tell you, and you, it'd be hard to deny this, Luke, you can't begin with no and ever get back to yes, a full-hearted yes. You can't.
Why can't you do that?
It's just the way the mind works mm-hmm. and the way that we invest ourselves in our judgments. Once you categorize or label something as inferior or dangerous or sinful or wrong, to then see the image of God in that person is practically impossible.
Yeah.
Practically. You might say you do, but you don't.
Yeah.
So contemplation is saying, I'm going to start with a radical yes. And so I'm not throwing out then that you might later move back to a position of, well, but there's some necessary no's here.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do it the other way around.
Yeah. Well, you talk about the first tier of consciousness as being focused on security and order and needs. Right?
Right.
And
right.
So it seems like if you're always judging, I mean, that seems to be kind of the security and order way of operating.
That's right. Very good connection. Yeah. It's wanting order, and you want yourself to be in charge of the order,
mm-hmm.
too.
Well, and as we're moving up this, I almost want to call it a hierarchy of needs because I've read Maslow, maybe. But, okay,
that's
so we get
good.
To the second. Second, my dad's a psychologist, so I have to, or he won't talk to me. I'm kidding, Dad. I know you don't think that way. Okay, but as we're moving up these tiers, like the second tier is we have a need for answers and explanations, which that makes a whole lot of sense. I went to seminary. I go there for – I want answers. I want explanations.
But
I want to get to the third tier where you say that's where Francis is, and obviously that's ultimately where Jesus was.
Okay.
So that's the ascension we're trying to get to, is past the needs for answers and explanations.
That's why it's called faith. You know, mm-hmm. we Christians have thrown around that word faith, mm-hmm. but a lot of people I meet who call themselves people of faith have no patience with darkness, ambiguity, mm-hmm. not knowing whatsoever. Mm-hmm. We've turned the biblical meaning of faith around 180 degrees to make it mean exactly the opposite of what the Bible says faith means. Faith is the willingness to not know and not even need to know. And that we made that into people who could strut around being just certain about everything, mm-hmm. is really, it's been disastrous for Western civilization.
Yeah.
Look at our politics in our country. I mean, we are no longer a wisdom culture. We can't even raise up people of wisdom very easily, because it's the triumph of dualistic thinking. And the best single example today is the political state of the United States of America, which is just makes you want to cry. And I'm not picking on either political party. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about both of them.
Yeah.
It's childish, you know. And any wise person, you don't even want to bother with it. It has so little to do with truth.
Yeah. Do you think the Eastern mind and the Eastern approaches to spirituality and Christianity have had a easier time getting to that place of faith in the Western mind?
That seems to be the evidence, you know. And mm-hmm. of course, we forget that the Semitic mind, the Aramaic language that Jesus spoke, mm-hmm. that we have almost no access to, by the way,
yeah.
Was much closer to the Eastern mind. It wasn't Greek. We were formed by Greek logic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The Western mind, which has a exactitude to it that is wonderful, a clarity to it that is wonderful. But we interpreted the teaching of Jesus from the first centuries through Greek translations. Most of the New Testament is written in Greek. I'm not against the New Testament. I teach from it myself, but we better know that the Aramaic language of Jesus was naturally much more contemplative. In other words, much more capable of subtlety, mm-hmm. of paradox, of nuance. It didn't encourage people to think one interpretation was the one and only interpretation. We see this if you've been a student in the seminary of Jewish Midrash. Mm-hmm. You know, Midrash is the Jewish approach to Scripture. They never talk like there's only one possible interpretation. They sit around and they have a heartfelt discussion. Well, Abraham could be saying this. Maybe Abraham means that. And this opens up the whole Abraham story, for example, to fruitful spiritual food. But we were trained now, you and I both, by reason of being Western Christians, into thinking there's only one possible interpretation. I mean, Augustine in the 4th century still said there were four levels of interpretation of every text.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways, we've gone backward, really,
yeah.
backward.
Yeah.
It's sad. It's very sad.
Yeah. One of the greatest examples, I think, from your teaching of this non-dualistic mind is what I'd almost want to call like an appreciation of suffering and pain. And you say elsewhere that many of the great spiritual teachers would say that the two paths for transformation are the way of love and prayer and the way of suffering.
And great love and great suffering. That's right.
Yeah.
And what prayer is really the third path. Mm-hmm. That allows you to find meaning and depth in love and suffering.
And so
that makes
yeah. And so the meaning okay. is that what you're talking about when you use the phrase the integration of the negative?
Oh, okay. Boy, you're making a lot of good connections. The integration of the negative is, you know, when we say God forgives sins, which is at the heart of Christian teaching, I think, right at the heart.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying God integrates the negative.
Yeah.
That's what it means. Okay, I know you sinned. And I wish you hadn't, but I'd sooner have a relationship with you than be right. That's what God is saying. Every time God forgives sin, which seems to be almost God's job description, you know?
Yeah.
To prefer relationship with his people instead of standing on a throne of righteousness. That's good stuff.
Yeah, that is definitely good stuff. Will you talk about pain as being like the rent we pay by being a human? But suffering is usually is optional. Can you explain what that means?
That's been said by many people, so that isn't original to me, Luke, but I'm glad it jumped out at you. Even the Buddha says, you know, pain is part of the deal. Anybody who observes reality from the animal level, the nature level, the human level, everything passes, everything changes form, nothing is permanent. I'm looking at a beautiful green tree, cottonwood, in my front yard right now. In a few weeks, it's going to start losing all its leaves. All right? Everything changes. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, so that's pain, if you want to call it. Everything dies and passes. Now, our attitude toward that, if we can say, well, God is even in this transformation of forms. And in fact, the death and resurrection of Jesus tells us that we can trust death, that it will lead to resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives it meaning, which ideally should keep the Christian from unnecessary suffering. You know, it's the meaninglessness of pain that is its greatest suffering.
Mm-hmm.
When there's tragedy and you can't find God in it, or purpose in it, or direction in it, then your heart is tramped on.
Mm-hmm.
But, and our faith tells us, even in this, God is involved. God will turn the crucifixions of humanity into resurrection. That's what we mean when we say we're saved by the death and the resurrection of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Not death or resurrection, death and resurrection.
Yeah. That's good. You talk about how on the cross Jesus is holding essentially meaninglessness and tragedy together, and that is the final triumph over this dualism and dichotomies that we face in our lives. And so the message of like Jesus on the cross is that even in this there is meaning, right?
There you go. You're understanding very well. You know, when you get it, the gospel in some ways is so simple. I know, you know, you and I are trained theologically, and you almost have to make it complex for a while, or it sounds complex. But when the insight comes, when the Spirit descends, if you can put it that way, the gospel becomes so simple.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, in a way, it becomes so obvious when you just look at things.
Yeah.
You know, contemplata was simply the Latin word for seeing, for deep looking, deep viewing, that you look at things in their depth and you can always find God.
Wow.
Always. The real sin, I think, is to stay on the surface. And then you'll never see God. And if you go to the depths, I talk about that in the book, Immortal Diamond. I don't know if you read that one, but when you go to the depths of... you're so cute and trusting. When you go to the depths of anything, even your sin, even your worst mistake that you want to hate yourself for, you will find God. You will.
Well, isn't that the idea in Immortal Diamond, is that you'd move past your false self and you'd find your true self, right?
That's it. When you go beyond the shadow and the disguise and my occupation and my gender and all these things we over-identify with, and you have to for a while, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, but those are just the vehicle, you know.
Yeah.
They're not the final identity of who you are, hidden with Christ in God, as Paul would say in Colossians.
Well, you talk about how this shadow self, or is that a similar comparison to false self? You would say those are pretty comparable?
Yeah, they certainly overlap in a major way.
Okay.
So, and that's why the shadow self, the false self isn't a bad self. Mm-mm. It's just the self we can't see, or we don't want to admit, or we don't want to identify with.
Yeah.
It's the rejected self. Yeah.
Well, you talk about how psychotherapy and counseling do really good jobs of helping deal with our shadow self, but religion needs to catch up with kind of some of the social sciences out there and mental health.
I think there's a lot of truth in that, and yet I'm going to say it on the other side too, Luke, that I think they have a lot to learn from us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many great therapists have said all so-called psychological problems at their foundation are spiritual problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we would have to keep saying that. But you're still right that there's an awful lot we can learn from good therapists. For many years, I had a Jewish therapist while at the same time having a priest spiritual director. And they both helped me, you know, go in to my own self and see some of the things I didn't want to see, and also see some of the things I very much did want to see.
Hmm.
But they came at it from different angles.
And you were going to both at the same time?
Yeah, during a certain period in my 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. when I think you've got to go through your dark nights in the middle of life.
Yes.
Where you wake up, and of course psychology calls it the midlife crisis, usually mm-hmm. in the mid-40s,
mm-hmm.
where you've built your tower of success, so-called,
mm-hmm.
and then you say, but what does it all mean? Mm-hmm. Why am I waking up today
yeah.
and doing this again and again? Mm-hmm. Whatever I'm doing.
Yeah.
I think that's what Dante is talking about in the Divine Comedy, waking up in the middle of life in a dark wood. It's the human experience.
Yeah, you know, you should write a book about the difference in the first half of spirituality and the second half of spirituality. That would be a really great book, I think you should do. So
you've read Falling Upward, haven't you?
Yeah, you know, actually, I gave a copy of that book to my dad, and he absolutely loved it. So,
did he?
Yeah.
And if he's a
psychologist,
therapist, that makes me very happy.
Well,
yeah,
the problem is he calls me up as soon as it gets, and he goes, well, Luke, do you think you're in the second half of life yet? And I'm like, Dad, I'm too young for that. No.
How old are you, Luke?
I'm 33.
Oh, yeah. Well, chronologically, you're still in the first half.
Yeah.
But that you can even appreciate what I'm trying to say. I'm 71.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you can even appreciate it speaks very well. And I would say that's a fruit of you submitting to the gospel. The gospel accelerates the whole path if you do it with integrity.
Well, my self-esteem is to the roof right now since you've given me a compliment. I don't know what to do. I'm going to need to humble myself. Okay, well, let's talk about the new book. Let's talk about Eager to Love. So you did you grow up Franciscan?
Well, no, I grew up, you know, a little German Catholic farm boy in Kansas.
Okay.
Couldn't be much more conservative and traditional.
Really?
But I joined the Franciscans as a young man. Yeah.
Where did your interest?
I went off to Cincinnati, Ohio, and joined them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Was there a seminary there?
Yes, there was a seminary. And this was, you know, in the 1950s, before the reforms of the Catholic Church
mm-hmm.
in the 1960s that we call the Second Vatican Council.
Okay.
So I grew up in a very traditional model of Catholicism,
mm-hmm.
which had very good aspects to it and some not so good, like every church. You know?
For those of us who aren't really familiar with that, what would you think be the most obvious differences?
Between the pre-Vatican II and post?
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, probably most of the things that Luther
mm-hmm.
criticized the Catholic Church for were in many ways still in place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were in many ways trying to save ourselves by going to church and obeying the law and
mm-hmm.
Following whatever the priest said. It was top-down religion.
Mm-hmm.
And Luther's critique was not incorrect.
Yep.
He might have gotten a little angry in the way he did it, but he was at least half right,
mm-hmm.
probably more than half.
Yeah.
So I was raised that way, but at the same time, it gave you an ego structure like if you grew up in fundamentalist evangelical world, that's not a bad way to start. Mm-hmm. It really isn't. Just as the Jew begins with the Torah, the law, huh? To start conservative, traditional, with clear do's and don'ts and boundaries, and I bet your father as a psychologist would say the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's the easiest way to grow up.
Why do you think that's
very hard to start liberal? Very hard.
Why do you think it's hard to start liberal?
Because you have no boundaries, no identity, very poor identity. So you have to grab all over the place. Mm-hmm. You know, this tattoo will do it. I'm not against tattoos, but this costume will do it. This being on stage will do it. This cool outfit will do it. Mm-hmm. It's all external self. Do you understand?
Yeah.
It's all window dressing. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, that's almost the entire youth culture of the United States of America. And you just want to weep because you talk about a dark night. When they hit their 30s and 40s, they're going to have even less to hearken back to.
Yeah.
Of what does it all mean? Now, you know, I've worn my tattoo for 30 years. Now I wish I could change it, but I...
You can't do that too well.
It's come on. Don't nail yourself into one little persona. Mm-hmm. It's too small. Growth, that's the great thing about being 71, is I see all the stages God led me through. And each one was good. But each one was only a stage, too.
Yeah. Well, that obviously must have been a great environment for you as, you know, growing conservative, to hear the message of Franciscan mysticism, which, as you describe in the book, you say the central practice is really to remain in love, which I don't care what background you come from. That's good news to anyone.
Wouldn't it be a wonderful world if we really could all do that?
Yeah.
But as you know, Luke, that's work.
It is.
To keep your mind and your heart open with betrayals and rejections that life offers you. Oh, everything in you wants to close down and build a little wall around yourself.
Yeah, that's not an easy thing to do.
But no, it isn't.
Now, you describe what Francis, and obviously Claire as well, that they had approached that you describe as a performative spirituality. Can you unpack what that phrase means?
Yeah, it's probably a somewhat abstract word, so thanks for asking it. The reason Francis and Claire in the 13th century, although they were called the first Protestants, but Catholic Church at that time was the only church in town. If you lived in Italy, the only way you could be Christian was to be Catholic. So they didn't know how to leave the church. They would just go to the edge and emphasize different things, which it became the religious orders. Now, what Francis and Claire emphasized, and this is why they never got into trouble with the powers that be, is they emphasize lifestyle, things like living simply, maybe like the Amish would do, or the Quakers, peacemaking, nonviolence, love of creation. Well, you can't call anybody a heretic for doing that. So when I say performative spirituality, I mean the emphasis was on how you actually lived your life. Mm-hmm. We didn't argue about the Trinity or the divinity of Christ or the virgin birth or anything that would become, you know, problematic or argumentative.
Yeah.
So performance is different. We call it orthopraxy instead of orthodoxy.
Yeah.
And I'm not against orthodoxy, but it's usually verbal.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have the right words?
Yeah.
I always say, we never burned anybody at the stake for not taking care of the widows and the orphans. You know?
Mm-hmm. No, we didn't.
Never, never. It was always their opinions about the Eucharist or the priesthood or the Bible or the liturgy or something. But isn't it a shame that the things that Jesus emphasized of healing and reaching out to the little ones, we never condemn anybody for not doing that.
Yeah.
That's very telling.
Yeah.
I'm sad to say.
So in this performative spirituality, it's about you know, as you describe, it's getting to know things in almost a cellular or energetic way. It's not just in your heads. And so there is a lot of, there are a lot of people, especially pastors like myself, who preach to people every week, that the way that we communicate is through trying to get people to think correctly, and therefore they will act correctly. But but thinking correctly doesn't get to acting correctly. It's usually the other way around.
It doesn't. So, that's one of the principles of our center here in Albuquerque. You don't think yourself into a new way of living. You live yourself into a new way of thinking.
Which, by the way, it is a great name, Center for Action and Contemplation.
Yeah, that's what we're called.
Well done on telling that. But for those of us who do preach and those of us who lead churches, how do we get to that ultimate goal of formation? If we're doing a lot of talking and shaping how people think, what can we do differently?
You know, and here's where I always say, I wish you Protestants had reformed us Catholics. But in many ways, you continued the same pattern. And what I mean by that is you define the following of Jesus as attending lectures our rituals on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Once we defined, and then we clergy, you and I both, we were put in charge of these little places. Well, to be perfectly honest, it has to do with job security. There's something in the very structure of church that we want to keep them coming back each Sunday. That's paying our bills.
Yep.
And so we keep defining church as attendance, instead of participation in a mystery. And I can see why the model sustained itself. It did give us a weekly forum to communicate our message, but unfortunately, just listening to the message became an end in itself. Yeah. Verbal Christianity instead of lifestyle Christianity.
Some people have talked about how this, you know, and I don't know what the phrase progressive Christianity means, but it seems like a lot of these people like what you're, they're picking up what you're putting down. Okay. So they like this idea, but it seems like it's very difficult to have, to sustain, to build a church using this kind of theology, because you're almost teaching people out of the building.
And I really agree with what you're saying there. So, you know, my book of meditations is called Yes And, because I like to talk yes, but there's the other side too. And you're making a good point that, okay, we got to release ourselves from the idea of church as attendance, but at the same time, the community, as the Jews taught us, need to have its rituals, needs to have its assembly to sustain the message. You need solidarity with like-minded people. You need an accountability system. So church both creates the strongest Christians, and it creates some of the most superficial. But I don't know. I don't know how we can. It's the vehicle for the vision. I don't know how we can go ahead without it.
Well,
so I don't mean to be dismissing church. I really don't.
No, and I've never come across that by reading your work.
Thank you.
Okay, but you talk about the superficiality of, you know, spirituality. And religion, as you say in the book, it sometimes is structurally created or structurally certain to create hypocrites. What are ways that we can, those of us who lead organized religion, get away from this?
Well, thank you for being so earnest in your questions, and they seem so sincere. When you have any high-minded organization, this is not just true of churches, but not-for-profits like our center here is in Albuquerque, you tend to gather people who agree with the ideology, the philosophy, in very often a somewhat superficial way. In other words, just joining that organization makes them think they live it, or they really believe it. Group affiliation, what I call belonging systems, are very often a substitute for actual transformation. I don't now have to change because I belong to the First Baptist Church of Abilene, Texas. I hope. I actually, we've had many visitors from Abilene who are wonderful people, so that's the only reason I pick on them.
No, I like Abilene.
Well, I do too. I spoke there once and met really wonderful people.
Where did you speak in Abilene?
It was some church right downtown.
Yeah.
Can't remember what it was.
Okay.
But what good people. But at any rate, you get my point.
Yeah.
It's belonging systems become substitutes for transformation. Mm-hmm. Just aligning yourself with this organization makes you think you really believe it. That's why I made the statement in the book that we're structurally set up to create hypocrites. Mm-hmm. They don't mean to be hypocrites. They think they're sincere, and to some level they are sincere. But, you know, you walk in, and we Catholics, we recite the Nicene Creed. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. Well, maybe. You don't even know what you're saying when you say that.
Yeah.
But it's easy to spout off a creed and not invest yourself in it the rest of the week in the least.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're structurally set up to create hypocrites, even sincere people.
Yeah.
And you know the word hypocrite, that as Jesus used it in Matthew's gospel, simply means an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not originally that negative a term. It's you're actors, you're pretending.
Mm-hmm.
And I've pretended enough in my life to know how common and easy that is to do.
Yeah. Yeah, true. Yeah. Okay, so there's one thing as a Protestant, I read the book, and I want to know if I have to buy into this to really get the whole Francis experience. Okay, so we talk about Francis. Awesome stuff. A lot of great things to say. Great example for all of us. And then we throw in the part about the stigmata. The last 2 years of his life, he gets that. And I'm going, wait a minute. Do I have to sign up for this? That kind of scares me.
You mean you getting the stigmata or believing that such a thing is possible?
Either one. I'd rather believe than experience it myself. Is that okay? Blessed are you who believe without seeing, right? Jesus said that.
Well, I think I'm just like you. You know, it is in 1224, this seems to have happened to him right around this time of year in mid-September.
Uh-oh.
It's so documented from so many sources.
Mm-hmm.
Eyewitnesses, and since then there have been other stigmatics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to admit, I'm in sort of awe, but also skepticism,
mm-hmm.
because we don't see this that much.
Mm-hmm.
But as I try to explain it in the book, Francis was the first known human being to have this.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, there have been others. That it's, here's my psychosomatic interpretation of that. I do think there are people who so totally identify with Jesus, and even Jesus on the cross, that it takes psychosomatic form in their body.
Mm-hmm.
And that was called a stigmata.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mystery. I don't think it's something we should seek or expect.
Mm-mm.
But no, I'm not for it. But we even have in Assisi, you've probably never been there in Italy, but in the one of the churches is still the sandals that Claire created for him so he could walk. Because he couldn't walk the last 2 years of his life, you know.
Wow.
He had these wounds in his feet. I don't know why God allows such things, does such things. I certainly don't think to believe in this is at all necessary or even important.
Mm-hmm.
But God is mysterious, and incidents like this certainly make us aware of that.
Well, I definitely agree that God is mysterious. So, Richard, thank you so much for your time. Love your work.
People like you give me great hope and great happiness. Thank you, Luke. It's good to talk with you.
Yes, sir.
God bless you all. Thank you.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.